I'm really pleased to welcome back to you from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum. Welcome back, Martin.
Thanks, Michael. It's fabulous to be here and great to round up what a fascinating election.
Well, it is fascinating. For political scientists, it's absolute grist for the mill. You can keep lecturing and writing and surmising over this for another 3 years, I imagine. But Martin, can I quickly ask you straight off just where we are at on the reps count and on the Senate figures?
On the reps count, Labor's about at 74, 75. I think we can confidently say 75. But there's about three more seats which are very much in play. And so around about 76, 77 is where we would expect them to land. Some of the counts are just close, you know, Labor versus Liberal, like Lyons, the seat of Lyons in Tasmania and the seat of Gilmore in New South Wales. But there's a couple of seats, McNamara and Brisbane, which are more complex than that. We're certain that the Liberals will lose them, or McNamara was already a Labor seat, right? But it's a three-way contest in those seats. So you just have to settle, you've got to count all the primaries first, then drop out their lower polling candidates, see who's left in the last two, and that will determine who will win. So until actually we've got all the primaries, we're not actually going to get a final result for those two seats.
So you're, I take it, saying there are these seats numbering four or so. I can't tell exactly how they're going to fall out, but I think Labor are going to pick up another two, getting them to 77. Is that the sort of thinking?
Yeah, it's 76 or 77 would be my guess. In the late counting, just based on who's in front, how many votes there are to go. Gilmore's the closest. I think there's a bit over 100 votes in it. I mean, that's really close. Lyons, Labor's got a bit bigger majority. I expect them to win that. Brisbane, and I think Labor win McNamara and the Greens win Brisbane. So, I mean, that takes them to about 77.
We'll come back to the question of how you fit a speaker into all of this, depending on the final numbers. But turning to the Senate, how does that look like working out?
Very interesting. So Labor's miles short of a majority in the Senate, but it always has been, because the sort of left vote, if you like, is split between Labor and the Greens. And the Greens are certain to go from 9 to 12. So actually the right-left shift has occurred there too. And as a block, they'll have more members than they had previously, but they'll still be short of a majority. So there'll be a crossbench, and expect the Jackie Lambie network to be quite important there, because I think they're really a genuine cross, vote for things depending on what the actual legislation is, depending on what the motion is. So they're less predictable. I'd expect on one side, you've got the coalition, Liberal and Nationals. On the others, you've got Labor and the Greens most of the time. And the contentious issue is where Jackie Lambie's mob will fall. I expect Pauline Hanson will keep her seat in the Senate. So it will be a hung parliament.
Now, everyone's fond of saying that, you know, a week's a long time in politics and so on. Even a day can be. We've had 5 days since the polls closed, nearly 5 days. What happened, Martin? These teals we knew about, I don't think we were all fully convinced that they would be as successful as they have been. No one seemed to tell us in chapter and verse about the Greens in Brisbane. And when you and I last talked, we thought Pearson Swan might well go to Labor. The idea that Tangney might was on a distant horizon. I don't think we're talking a lot about Hasluck. Couldn't imagine that the Indigenous Minister, Ken Wyatt, would lose his seat. And the idea that Moore might have come into play seemed ridiculous. And yet all of that has come to pass. So I'm wondering, is there some sort of thread that binds all of those electoral moves and shifts and activity together? Is WA an anomaly in all of this?
Some really good questions there. I'll do the last one first. Yes. So what you saw in the eastern states, or most places but WA, you saw a significant swing away from the Liberal Party. around 5%, a bit over 5%, which is significant. But Labor didn't necessarily pick a lot of that up. Their vote was fairly static, and it went to the Independents and the Greens and a range of minor parties. And that's why you've got such a big crossbench. And it's kind of mixed bag. In fact, a lot of us were thinking that there'd be a hung parliament until the WA results came in. WA was different. There was a big swing, a massive swing away from the Liberal Party, and Labor got a big chunk of it, with some going to the Greens, who also improved a bit, and a little bit in Curtin to the Independent, Kate Chaney. So much bigger swing, direct swing from Liberal to Labor, and a bigger swing in Western Australia. And I think it's actually fair to say that Western Australia has delivered the Labor Party majority government. Without it, you'd certainly have a hung parliament. So it was very decisive in the election.
Well, assuming Labor gets its majority, and it probably doesn't matter even if it were to fall one short, as your learned editor here predicted it might in last week's The Weekly Edition of the Shipping News, sort of trying to boost his stocks as a pundit. But assuming all of that, I mean, how is Labor going to govern? What sort of government's going to be? What are the issues that it might proceed to tackle with some speed? What's going to be in the longer term? What's your take on the big issues for Labor?
This is an excellent question, and it's a very pertinent question at the outset of a new government, isn't it? I think they've got a lot on their plate. So you have all the victory, you have all the euphoria and triumphalism, et cetera, and then you've got to get down to work. And to give you some idea of the calibre of this, they've committed to a referendum in this term for the Indigenous voice. And there's a lot of complex work to go on before that to thrash out a proposal that meets the aspirations of Indigenous people, but is likely to succeed in the broader population as well. You know, against a backdrop where referenda haven't been that successful. So, you know, there's a fair bit in that alone. Then you've got an integrity commission that they've committed to producing a bill this year. So that's an immediate concern that they have to do. They're going to get pushed to do more on climate, no doubt about it. And they're all things before you even think about the economy, because you've got the cost of living, which is rising, inflation, which is becoming a bit of an issue, housing affordability, all of those bread and butter concerns as well, and you're facing a budget deficit. So there's a lot on their plate. Those troubles will pile up, I think, and they're going to have to work really hard. I think maybe we'll come to it next on how they might address the crossbench, because I think that's really important too.
Let's come to that. We've already, in the last 24 hours, seen something, I think, of what the tone of a new parliament might be, particularly in light of the Teal Independents, the Greens, sitting around in the parliament and watching all of this happening, and really a call that ordinary citizens have been making for years for people to behave. We can't go, for example, calling Peter Dutton Voldemort anymore. Paul Keating might have got away with it, I suppose, once upon a time, although even he was happy enough just to talk about wet lettuces in his day. But how will Labor try to behave? Can you stick to it?
It's an interesting one. This sort of gentle rebuke, you might call it, of Tanya Plibersek for comparing Peter Dutton to Voldemort was interesting. I think it's a good thing, not because people sling insults all the time at each other, and some of us might find that a really funny one. It's just the challenge is, if you're trying to create a different tone, if you're trying to steer people away from personal attacks based on their appearance, then no matter who it is, you've got to be consistent about it. And I think if the Prime Minister doesn't do that now, then the personal attacks will continue. And I actually think it's this personal slanging between the major parties that is not solely responsible, but in part responsible for so many people turning off and choosing other options. So him trying to keep that tone going for the whole of the term will be extremely challenging. You know what parliamentary debate's like. I wonder how long he can. But I think that if he's smart, what he should also be doing is reaching out to the crossbench talking through what their concerns are, seeking some consensus and support for the things that he's doing. With the concept of the Indigenous voice, he will have to consult with the opposition. I don't know who that person will be or who those people will be, but referenda are very difficult to get past if you don't build broad consensus. So he's going to have to really kind of reach across the aisle more and try and set that tone really early in his prime ministership in order to achieve broad support for some of the things he's working on.
I should add here, frequent and regular readers of the Shipping News will already have come across these articles, but we've posted a piece on the statement from the heart, the Uluru statement, the question of treaty, Makarrata, the question of truth-telling, and the question of the voice to Parliament. People might be interested to read that. Similarly, we've posted a number of opinions in the last couple of days on the question of what's required in the climate space, and we previously published on the Federal ICAC, Federal Integrity Commission topic, and if people search on the Shipping News, they'll discover those very quickly, which, of course, the so-called teal independence, the Greens are also strongly supportive of, and we can expect action on them. But that sort of raises a question, A, whether we can expect some formal written accord between the independents or some of them in the government, and who's going to be the speaker in all of this? That's a person who can help, of course, and is very much tied up in keeping the right tone in Parliament.
The speaker one will be interesting. I know some people have suggested that an independent take the role, but what they don't quite understand there is that many independents are reluctant to take that role because they don't vote. And voting on things matters when you're an independent because you need to be seen to be standing up for your electorate. So if you're voted in as an independent and you take that role, you'd be seen as sort of acquiescing with the government and losing your voice in for your electorate in Parliament. So I don't think there'll be much appetite by any of those independents, even those like Helen Haynes who've been around a while, to take on that role. If you're in your last term maybe and you're not thinking of running again, that might be different. So then you know, it goes to Labor candidates, and I think the best candidates you should aspire to back an excellent speaker is someone who no longer has aspirations, political aspirations of their own, because they're likely to be more honest, more fair, more impartial. I know that doesn't always suit a prime minister or ministers, but it actually makes for a better running of Parliament, and I think that'd be the best choice.
If Labor had the 76 number only and a speaker comes out of Labor, does that affect the voting protocols?
Yeah, what it means is because the speaker by convention votes when the vote's tied. So you could get tied votes in theory, at least of let's say everyone's turning up, which actually rarely happens, but you could get 75 each and then the speaker has to cast the casting vote. So they can still win votes with a Labor speaker. It's just incredibly tight. I think they would much prefer to have 77 and then win votes on their own using 76 MPs. Because the other problem with 76 is it gives you no room at all if someone retires, or if there's a scandal or some problem and someone disenchanted moves to the crossbench, you suddenly lose majority government. So I think they'd much prefer to see 77 than 76.
Just coming back to the fact that there's going to be a large crossbench, whether you look at it, have you started to think about how that's going to affect the way government operates, Parliament operates, the public space more generally in Australia will be perceived in the next 3 years?
It's a really fascinating question because a lot of us have noticed the minor party voting creeping up election after election. Each election, major party vote shares tended to decline. And you wonder at what level, now we're getting to a third of the entire electorate this time in the House of Representatives, around about that, right? Not quite, but around about that, not voting for the major parties. So sooner or later, they're going to be winning electorates. And that's happened this time around. So does that signal a long-term trend? Well, in voting, we know it does. But I think you probably need to wait another election cycle or so to see whether it's those independents can hang on, whether more electorates choose to go down that path, etc. But it's certainly been an earthquake this time to see such a big crossbench, the biggest in the history of the Australian Parliament.
Martin, some commentators very often found expressing their opinions after dark on a certain pay TV channel seem to be encouraging the coalition or the Liberal Party or Nationals as well to go, to use the expression, further to the right to mark themselves off from a quote-unquote radically left-wing government, close the quote. Do you see any major changes in the positions these historical major parties place themselves in the next couple of years?
What you get after every change of government is that the mob who loses spend some time reflecting amongst themselves about the direction of their party. And that's natural. And the problem that the Liberal Party in particular has had is that they've copped an absolute smashing. So even though Labor is just may just form a majority or may not, but one thing we know is that the number of Liberal seats has just crashed. And they've lost a lot of votes in their heartland in metropolitan areas. So they've got some really, really got some thinking to do. And there are different points of view. So you get some sort of conservative commentators like Peter Credlin that want to see them move further to the right. And I just don't know how that helps you win back all of those voters you lost in metropolitan areas. I can't see how that's a wise strategy. I think in our system of government, our two major political parties at least have won government by appealing to a broad range of people. And I think that's got to be the focus for the Liberal Party, is how do they reshape their brand, so to speak, to appeal to some of those people in metropolitan areas that they've lost.
Can I bring us back to WA for a moment? As I said earlier, one could see how there were a couple of seats, Pearce and Swan, that might easily, in one sense, fall if there's any sort of swing on. But what did happen? Was there anything special that happened in Hasluck and in Tangney?
I would say that what we saw in WA was not so much a personal swings against members, but a broad indictment on the government and how it's seen in Western Australia. So I think that broader issues, did Scott Morrison stand up for WA when he had the chance to, or didn't he? And clearly the Labor campaign, which focused on his support for Clive Palmer's border challenge and associated comments like the caveman comment, et cetera, I think was pretty influential. I think that was the bigger picture in Western Australia, or whether in some of the inner city areas, whether the government had done enough on climate change. I think those issues were more important than whether Ken Wyatt was popular in Hasluck, or whether Ben Morton was popular in Tangney, or whether the new candidates for the Liberal Party had traction in Swan and Hasluck, Pearce. If you do look at the broader picture, there's pretty big consistent swings in Western Australia, which tell us it's not about candidates, it's about the overall Liberal brand, which is really struggling here.
Sort of related to that broader issue, Martin, when I was a kid finishing primary school at the end of the 50s and then eventually getting to vote in the late 60s, there was always talk about sectional votes and which parties they might go with in a political spectrum that was pretty much Liberal and Country Party on one side and Labor Party on the other. And not long after the famous split, people would talk about who would get the Catholic vote. And then beyond all of that, we started to look at ethnic votes, look large immigrant populations, Melbourne, lots of Greeks, Perth had a strong Italian community as well as the Greeks, and so on. The question of an Asian and a Chinese ethnic vote seems to have been raised by some of the commentators around the country. Do you see anything happening on that front, or is that just commentators trying to make some simple sense in election?
Yeah, this sectional argument, I think both has some traction, but we've got to be careful not to generalise. That's my nutshell comment there. So take the Chinese vote, for instance. The Liberal Party did poorly in Bennelong and Chisholm, which are two Chinese-based seats. Chinese-based seats is too much of a generalisation. Two communities where they have a strong presence. How about we say that? And also Sam Lim did well in Tangney here as well. That has another significant Chinese community. All of that tends to suggest that, yes, the Liberal brand was struggling with that particular cohort. But you've also got to remember there's other things like Labor did poorly in Fowler, which is a strong Vietnamese community. So I think major parties have got to make sure that they can speak to these different communities effectively. They've also got to be very careful that their choice for candidates reflects those communities. And I think that probably helps explain why Sam Lim did so well, but it also might explain why Dai Lai did so well in Fowler. These were communities which had strong multicultural communities, and representation needs to change to reflect that more broadly.
I noticed the informal vote seems to be a lot higher, particularly high in some electorates. The Senate's probably a bit of a mess. And even when I last looked, Fremantle versus Curtin, informal votes are up and down. What do you make of it? Is it something to do with how long the ballot sheet is these days, or how many candidates are running, or what is it?
There have been certainly patchy areas where the informal vote is high. It's also been suggested that in non-English speaking communities, the informal rate is a bit higher. That should be some form, that should be a source of concern in my view, because it's really important that people know and understand how to vote. Some people will choose to vote informally, and that will always be the case, but that's actually pretty consistent across most elections. So if it's rising, then there's perhaps a question there about education and making sure people know how to vote, they understand that. I've got another slight theory, right? And it's that if you have voting for the major parties declining, and this was a record low vote in that respect, you might get slightly higher informality, because when people are voting for the major parties, they just, well, some of them at least, just follow the how to vote card. So they get it, they go, okay, I know what I'm doing, and just fill it out. If they're making other choices, not following a how to vote card, they're probably a bit more free range. Are they still filling out the ballot correctly? They're all interesting questions, I think.
Martin, in the couple of minutes we have left, I suppose everything draws us to this big question, and it's a question that you and I can keep talking about, and that is the evolution of parties to this stage of Australia's political culture and what the future might hold. But taking everything into account, do you think, like some people are suggesting or want to be true, that the two-party system has just died a death?
It's an interesting argument. I think we probably need to see another cycle or two to be really confident about this. Clearly, this was a blow to the two-party system, not because it's a hung parliament, but because their vote has been declining so badly and because so many seats have been won by the crossbench. But another cycle or two will probably tell us how entrenched that is, which will be an interesting one. I would make the point, and some of your listeners will probably be aware of this, they're a very educated bunch, that party membership has been declining for a long time in the major parties. So they don't have a huge ballast of members in the way that they used to have. And overall, I think people are less sticky when it comes to major parties. You know, they're willing to try different things. They're more volatile in their voting patterns. We saw that here in Western Australia with a massive swing from Liberal to Labor. People are probably a bit less rusted on these days, and they'll vote according to the circumstances. So I think that's another thing to throw into that mix, if you ask me.
We touched on this in the last podcast. It seems that the idea that chaos would reign if independents were elected, that warning hasn't been heeded in many electorates. Do you think we're in for a period of chaos?
No, I think that we're in for a period of very interesting parliamentary debate with some different types of voices perhaps inserted. But let's keep this in mind. We're still probably likely to have a Labor majority, and that itself brings some degree of stability if that's what really rocks your boat, I guess. But even in the essence of, I don't think this is going to be a, it will be a feisty parliament. It will be, that never changes. But I think it, if the government, particularly Albanese's style, is to be more inclusive and consensus-based, he might be able to get a lot done.
Well, Martin, we're in for an interesting time. It's obviously been an extremely significant election for all the reasons we've been touching on today. It'll be interesting to look at the state of play next Thursday when we meet. Thanks for giving us your view from the Roundhouse today.
My absolute pleasure, Michael.